from stpetecatalyst.com.
Hi, I'm Bill DeYoung, and this is the Catalyst Sessions. Roy Peter Clark has taught writing at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies for well over 30 years now. He was but a child when the St. Petersburg Times brought him in as a writing coach in 1977 and a staff writer. And he began a long association then with the American Society of Newspaper Editors, news outlets, and journalism schools all over the country, nay, around the world. This guy has authored or edited 19 books about reading, writing, language, and journalism. His book, Writing Tools, 55 Essential Strategies for Every Writer, has sold over 250,000 copies and has been translated into 8 languages. He was, and apparently still is, the keyboard player for a rock and roll band here in St. Pete called the Fabulous Nosecaps. He is, in fact, a musician and a poet, and partly through his heroic efforts, the brown pelican was named the official bird of St. Petersburg this past January. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm so happy to introduce you to Roy Peter Clark. Hey, buddy.
Hey, buddy. You just fill me with the urge to play a little music for you.
Let's have it.
All right.
A musician and a poet.
So this is an original song based on a poem that's 100 years old. And it's called the St. Pete Pelican Song. And it goes like this. A wonderful bird is the pelican. His bill will hold more than his belly can. He can keep in his beak food enough for a week, but I'm damned if I see how the hell he can. So that's the original poem, that limerick written by Dixon Merritt 100 years ago. That is me. Down in Florida, way in St. Petersburg, we all marvel to see such a special bird. How it soars and then stops, then dives down and kerplops. It's now time for the people to spread the word. Everybody now. Wonderful bird is the pelican.
Hey now.
His bill will hold more than his belly can. He can keep in his beak food enough for a week, but I'm damned if I see how the hell he can. Now this next chorus is based on something that actually happened to me. Day I looked up at a clear blue sky. A squadron of birds, they were flying high. And oops, just like that, they all pooped on my hat. I consider myself quite a lucky guy. A wonderful bird is the pelican. His bill will hold more than his bellican. Jimmy Buffett, are you listening? Keeping his beak food enough for a week. But I'm damned if I see how the hell he can. Yes, I'm damned if I see how the hell he can. I've never written a song, Bill, that didn't have a cha-cha-cha ending. I just want to say that for the record.
Now, that must be in one of your books somewhere. If you're writing a song, you have to have this succinct little cha-cha-cha at the end just to give that little emphasis.
I have to say that there's actually one more chorus that I would call it the public service announcement. Now, Gary Marino, the great local historian, sent me a message after he read some of my pelican stories. He told me something I didn't know, that about a century ago, there was a bounty put out on brown pelicans. Because of the misperception by fishermen in the area that the pelicans were eating up all the fish at a time when the fisheries were down for other kinds of reasons. And so for a period of time, pelicans were being killed. Now, since that time, there wasn't those intentional attacks, but we know how many hundreds of pelicans have been killed as a result of being hooked on fishing lines.
Oh, yeah, fishing lines, yeah.
You know, all over the place. Yeah. So I'll just read it. The final chorus probably spoke. I envision this. I see Jimmy Buffett speaking this in front of like hundreds of thousands of people. Never cast your line near a pelican. He might get hooked up in a fatal jam. Once he's entwined in monofilament line, he can only be saved by those who give a damn. So one of the, I think the good things that's going to happen with the new pier is that it's going to create a much safer zone for the pelican and all seabirds than the one that existed before in the previous piers, where people essentially were invited to, you know, to buy bait fish and feed them to pelicans, putting them in that kind of danger zone. So Audubon and other people in the state are doing really, really good work educating fishermen. And, you know, look, my friend Jeff Klinkenberg used to be a longtime outdoors writer for the Times. I said, Jeff, no, I'm not going to go camping with you, buddy. My idea of roughing it is spending a night at a Holiday Inn Express, you know. So I'm Mr. Indoors, not
mine
Mr.
too. Cheers.
But I just got caught up in the beauty and mystery of the brown pelican. So here's the St. Peter's bird.
Yeah, absolutely, St. Peter's bird. We wanted to stop here before we got started chatting a little bit to talk about what's going on in the country this week and today. And you said before we went on that you did want to say something. I know that Mr. Trump is on right now talking about what's going on. And it does seem a little frivolous to talk about that, even though the brown pelican is grand, well, with all that's going on around here. But, you know, here we are, man, and the world keeps turning. Yeah, and the world needs pelican songs.
Well, you know, I think I've been writing a lot and very seriously about the responsibility of journalists and other public writers, how to perfect their craft, how to create an environment where readers and audiences really understand what's going on in the world, and also how to take responsibility for your words and actions. And I'm proud to work for the Poynter Institute, home of PolitiFact, and which owns the Tampa Bay Times. No, and it's hard going. I made a little list. I said, okay, let's say there was a pandemic, or let's say there was an economic collapse, or let's say there was social unrest on the streets, the cities were burning. Okay, let's add tropical storms that might turn into hurricanes. And any four of those events would sort of stand out in the public mind as among the most serious stories that you could cover. The fact that they would converge on us at this time and that we would be kind of reimagining our lives and our responsibilities and our communities and our homes in order to deal with these issues is very daunting. I was thinking of this, you know, one time the Nose Caps were playing a music festival up in Clearwater, and it was right during the Rodney King events out in LA. And usually we go on with like Wooly Bully.
Yeah.
And we said, no, we can't do that. What are we going to do? And in about 15 minutes, we taught ourselves Buffalo Springfield's, you know, For What It's Worth.
For What It's Worth. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I just gave myself a chill just even sort of thinking about, you know, that something's happening here.
That was about what the Watts riots or something, L.A. in '65.
So yeah. We've always had music. The civil rights, you know, we had an event at the Palladium in March of 2017, honoring the 100th anniversary of the Pulitzer Prizes, and. And our theme was the prizes that had won for social and racial justice.
Yeah.
And we had a gospel choir singing protest songs. John Lewis was there giving speech to the journalists. And at the end, I was on stage and I found myself astonishingly like holding hands with
John Lewis and our deputy mayor, Kanika Jelts Tomlin, who's a former student of mine, as the choir was, as the whole audience was singing, "We Shall Overcome." And so music has been a powerful force for understanding. One of my heroes, Little Richard, just passed away. Yeah. And I've been reading his biography. And one of the first records I ever owned, probably bought with my own money, maybe 8 or 9 years old, 78, right? It was a 78 RPM, big vinyl disc.
Yeah.
It was not his original song. He covered it, but it was called "Keep a Knockin'," and he played it all his life. It went like this, if I can try it. I mean, if I didn't love him, I wouldn't try to sing his song. Keep a knocking, but you can't come in. Keep a knocking, but you can't come in. Keep a knocking, but you can't come in. Go back to the knock and try it again.
Yeah.
I just always thought of that as just like this wild rave until I talked to a writer for Rolling Stone. He said, "Why don't you think about that, Roy, as a protest song?" I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, here's a young black man growing up in Macon, Georgia, a gay man during the Jim Crow era. And what does the song say? Keep a knocking, but you can't come in. Keep a knocking, but you can't come. But don't give up. Come back tomorrow night and try it again." So I've heard the music of the 50s and the 60s, especially from black artists, in a completely different way since I heard that song.
I wonder if music is going to, soothe the savage beast at this point. Sometimes you wonder unfortunately, you wonder every time something like this happens, if it's, This is the last one. What if we finally got, Armageddon coming, or there's no turning back now. The whole thing's going to be flipped on its back.
Yeah.
On that note, we could go on about this all night, my friend. Listen, here's a question for you, okay?
Right.
It's a chicken or the egg question, Roy, and this is what I got. I got to get myself out of the funk of talking about what's going on today. Mm-hmm. When the times brought you aboard, during what I consider was kind of the very start of the last golden age of newspaper journalism.
Right.
So it was kind of fun. I started dipping my toe in there. I got in at the tail end of it. Was it as a writing coach who occasionally wrote, or was it as a staff writer who, would be able to teach others about syntax and grammar? I mean, what were you brought? There's a little bit of mystery in your bio about what were you brought in as?
So I was at this past Friday would have been my 50th college reunion. Mm. I went to a small Catholic all male at the time school, Providence College in Rhode Island.
Yeah.
And I was on an academic scholarship, and then I came under the influence of some wonderful literature teachers, and I wanted to be like them.
Yeah.
So I worked my way. I went back home to Long Island to Stony Brook University, where I got a PhD in English literature and learned something about teaching composition, teaching writing to college students. And I applied for 100 jobs and got 4 interviews and 1 job offer from a branch campus of Auburn University in Montgomery, Alabama. Mm-hmm. Called AUM, Auburn University of Montgomery. And I had a little baby daughter and no more money. And so we took that job in Alabama for $11,500 a year in 1974. We got paid in Alabama once a month.
Right.
And
this was as a coach.
As a assistant professor of English.
Oh, at the school. Yeah, okay.
And I taught there. Yeah. I taught there for 3 years.
Okay.
And I came under the influence of a group of journalists, editorialists, who were among the white progressive editorialists of the day. We can think about people like Eugene Patterson, who eventually hired me.
Yeah.
But Ray Jenkins was the editor in Montgomery. And, you know, the most significant professional decision I ever made as a New Yorker was to move to Montgomery, Alabama. Mm-hmm. At the end of the classic period of the civil rights era, the beginning of the New South, and I was seeing all different kinds of things and learning all kinds of things that I wanted to write about. But the academic journals didn't provide me with a venue.
Yeah.
So I began to write essays, op-ed pieces. They were published in the New York Times. I wound up being interviewed on the Today Show. And I said, wow, the power of this is amazing. I want to learn more about this, more about the craft of journalism so I can teach it, add it to my repertoire.
Okay.
Gene Patterson, in 1977, became president of the American Society of Newspaper Editors.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, Gene was among the most writerly of editors.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Yeah.
One of Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
And he wrote a signed column in the Atlanta Constitution every day for 9 consecutive years. And Ray Arsenault and I published a collection of those. The change.
Oh, yes.
So
yes.
Gene wanted to conduct an experiment. Could he bring in an outsider to, they didn't have this word, but to be a writing coach to the staff. And so someone mentioned me. He brought me in for an interview. February of 77th, and I came for what was supposed to be a one-year visit. Nelson Pointer died in June of 1978.
Yes.
And so the mechanism for the creation of his school, the what became the Pointer Institute, became an opportunity for me to continue my work. But before I did that, Mr. Patterson and I agreed that I should come into the newsroom as a writer and try my hand and learn the craft all over again, but from the perspective of a journalist. And that's 40 years ago.
That's thank you for explaining that to me. While you were doing that, I was a copy boy at mm-hmm. the Times. And, you know, these were the days of Gene Patterson and Bob Heyman and, oh my God, Howell Raines was there when I was there.
Howell Raines was the first writer who let me coach him. And Howell had two books come out in the same month, a novel called Whiskey Man and an oral history of the civil rights movement called My Soul Is Resting. And I'm saying, how am I going to coach this guy? <It's> got, you tell him to use more active verbs in his next book. But he took me out on assignments and showed me how he worked, how he interviewed. And it became a lifelong friendship that has existed to this day.
That's absolutely. You were going to stay for a year, and here you are still. You know, first of all, it was called the Modern Media Institute in the beginning, was it not? Before it became the Pointer Institute.
Yeah, 556 Central Avenue. The building is still there, converted Brooklyn Bank building. It's for lease right next to the Emerald Bar, which is still there.
I'm sure that was a popular hangout.
Yeah.
Among journalists as I do.
No one imagined that that little storefront where I taught for 6 years would become a internationally significant journalism institution. Now, essentially, the global center for the fact-checking discipline.
What was it like in those early days at the storefront?
There were, you remember what St. Petersburg was like in the mid-70s.
It was God's waiting room, Roy. I was born and raised here.
Yeah, it was a ruin.
Yeah.
and Central Avenue, you're more likely to, if you bump into somebody, that person is likely to be either inebriated or, you know, was wandering aimlessly. Mm-hmm. And the building itself had termites in the walls. It had pigeons in the ceilings. And there was, because it was a bank building, there was a vault in the back. And there was so little space that we held one-on-one writing conferences and stored T-shirts in a vault. Mm-hmm. But we outperformed our resources, mostly because of the influence of Gene Patterson, who was a national leader. And so I was traveling all over the country in those days, meeting with top editors at the biggest newspapers, telling them about this little writing experiment. And suddenly they were writing teachers and writing coaches. And then in the 80s and 90s, long narrative series, all kinds of writing experiments that I think, looking back, we can be proud of, that St. Petersburg became the center for writing improvement in journalism, not just in the United States, but around the world.
Hey, you know, the Times, some of those series that people like Thomas French, you know, who I know is a friend
and
of yours.
Yeah.
And Klinkenberg stuff, the writing, you know, as you probably know, my sister was a writer at the Times in the 70s, Karen DeYoung. And
I heard her on NPR about 2 days ago.
She won't quit. She's what's the word? Indefatigable. But that was really how I got interested in reading the newspaper when I was a dumb kid. You know, now I'm a dumb adult, right? But the Times, you could just see it getting better and better and better over the years. And I love those series. And I'm talking about the Floridian, you know, but sometimes just the Sunday Features Front series, amazing stuff. You did a stint though as a writer. I remember talking to you about some stuff, some movie. It was a Robert Altman thing that I wrote about. Because it had your byline on it. And you're like, well, yeah, I remember that. So you actually, what was that experience like? I'm going to go be a journalist, be a newspaper writer now.
So one of the things, by the way, I did 28 stories in about 2 months on Robert Altman's dreadful movie, Health.
Health. I read them all. Read everyone.
I was very competitive. But, you know, it occurred to me early that while I learned my craft following different beats, that it wouldn't do the newspaper any good to have me writing stories, writing the same kinds of stories that other reporters would do.
Yeah, logically.
That if I wanted to grow as a teacher and a writer, I wanted to kind of test the form of newspaper writing.
Yeah.
And I wanted readers not to be shocked, but to read something that I wrote and say, how the heck did that get in the paper? And either laugh or cry. So what happened is that after I went back to Pointer, I believe I became a privileged freelancer at the Times. So it didn't mean they would run everything I wrote. But when I went to Paul Tash with an idea in 1995 for an experimental series on AIDS called Three Little Words, following a family where the father had died of AIDS under mysterious circumstances and the effects on his wife and children. Eventually wound up writing a 29-part series in February of 96, in which each chapter was only 800 words long. So rather than ask a reader, let's say, to spend an unusual amount of time keeping up with a series that had very long parts. I said, what if we just gave them something the length of a newspaper column and help them develop the habit of reading? And I'm in conversations now, given the fact that Dr. Fauci became well known back during the AIDS epidemic. It looks like we may either revive that that series or maybe do a podcast surrounding it. And then another one I can think of is that I believe that Dave Barry, the humorist, and I are the only two journalists who attempted to write a funny story about our colonoscopies. And I've challenged him to a duel, but he won't step up to the plate.
That's a very small club. you got me thinking about something. I had some written down questions and the hell with it. This is something I thought of, which is one of your books is called How to Write Short. And to me, I spent 35 years as a journalist, and it's an art. I'm not saying I ever perfected the art of journalism. What I'm saying is writing short is an art. It's always used to tell people, and I know you tell people this too, that writing short is much more difficult than writing long. You could have, if you'll pardon the expression, diarrhea of words, you can be beautifully descriptive, but if you can say it in 200 words instead of 1,000, you got people's attention. Why is that?
I think there's a word called logorrhea next time, which means excessive word.
I'm going to remember that. Thank you for that. I'm going to make a note over here. Yeah.
So I learned the lesson. I went to Tucson with my wife for a book festival. And I heard Scott Simon give a keynote. Mm-hmm. And he's turned out to be a very good, he's been a generous supporter of my work, interviewed me one time on for NPR. And he was talking about a lesson that his father taught him, that challenged the expression that a picture's worth 1,000 words. And he said, let's think about these historical documents. And he made a list. And I scribbled down what he'd said. He said, the Hippocratic Oath, the 23rd Psalm, any Shakespeare sonnet, the preamble to the Constitution, the Gettysburg Address, and the last passages of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, which are often quoted.
Yeah.
He said, take those seven documents, and if you were to add up the words in all of those documents, they would add up to fewer than 1,000 words. Now, I did not believe it. And I went home, and those documents exist in different forms, but I took the most efficient forms of those documents and I added them up, and they added up to 996 words.
Wow.
And his point was that there is something in the history of communication whereby people who wanted to create the most memorable text chose the shortest forms, shortest writing forms. Now, we can boil that down to a writing lesson for sentences, too. That when a good writer chooses, has something important to say, something that they want to persuade you is the gospel truth. The fact that Jesus wept, that they place it in the shortest possible sentence. And since I learned that lesson, I've seen it over and over again. By the way, writers of ill intent, some of whom write on Twitter, for example, write with short sentences in short forms too. So the craft is not good enough. It has to be the craft married to a public spirit, married to a sense of mission and purpose for community and democracy, whatever you're trying to persuade. And I think if you want people to remember things, short form is the way to go. And I think maybe no form manifests itself more than music. I have a shorter, I'm 72 years old. My short-term memory is going like this. Oh, what happened over here a second ago? Yeah. Whereas the lyric of a song that I haven't heard of or thought of for 40 years
sure.
will come to me. And I think that's part of the power of music. Not just the brevity, of course, but the repetition of key elements.
Well, to that point, and we're getting close to the end here, but I have one more thing. But to that point, tell people about the nose caps. I know it was Foley, Mike, the wonderful Mike Foley, who bitched me out on more than one occasion, and Mr. Klinkenberg and some other people. I don't remember, but it's just sort of the newspaper, the usual gang of idiots, right? I mean, started doing that in early 80s, maybe?
Early 80s, I was in the newsroom until just going over to Pointer, but already by 1979 we were playing at house parties.
Oh yeah,
and Foley had
R&B songs, right?
Yeah, Foley had been the drummer in the Mad Dogs back in I think Clearwater High School. It was Jeff Klinkenberg. There was Dave Schieber, who I still play with.
Dave's
great. Family to this day is one of the most talented musical families you'll ever meet. Greg Huffman, who worked in the business section, but went to University of Florida and was friends with Tom Petty. And when the boys had a new album come out, they came over to his house to listen to it, and they made fun of his of his record player, of his Beverly Childs, who was married to Joe, the late, great, wonderful Kathy Foley was in that band as well. And we played for seven people. We played for a State Farm insurance party, a Christmas party, where the people who were at the party left before the band did.
I had a few of those gigs, yeah.
And we played... We were the last band before the fireworks in Straub Park.
Wow.
You played a lot. Not Woodstock, but we're looking out on the big crowd.
Straub Park, man.
Yeah.
That's a nice gig. Yeah.
And it was great fun, tremendous fun. And we didn't take ourselves too seriously. We rarely practiced. And I think what was absolutely clear by everybody who was watching and dancing is that we were having so much fun. And that spirit carried through to a great reunion we had about 3 years ago.
Are you going to do it again? You're not too old to do it. Yeah.
Do it.
Hopefully Clank's watching this up in the mountains somewhere. And
Yeah. Jeff is the, Jeff was the best tambourine player and cowbell player that I ever played with.
That's saying something. Yeah.
He was a good singer. But when it came to lifting equipment or moving stuff, you know?
Yeah.
You always had this little back problem.
Oh, I know that trick. Hey, Roy, well, I'm so sorry to say we're almost out of time. Would you like to read something, or do you have something that prepared that I would love that if you would, because
I'll
wordsmith. How about
I read just a short poem that I wrote?
Yeah, I'd love that.
That in fact you guys published a couple of weeks ago, and then maybe I'll just do about 30 seconds of rock and roll on the keyboard.
Okay. Take us now, baby.
All right.
Roy, thank you.
You're welcome. This is a poem in the Shakespearean sonnet style called House Arrest, St. Pete, Florida, April 2020. I feel the pounding beat of house arrest, a sentence that we serve till who knows when. We do what all our wardens think is best and face a viral ban we hope to bend. We're stuck at home except to take a walk where seagulls croak their freedom overhead. My wife and I, we talk and talk and talk. I think divorce, but that joke's left unsaid. We live in times as fickle as the moon, who grins at us with all his pals, the stars. What month is this? Now April, May, or June? My God, please let them open up the bars. Pandemics are not so bad, I think. I hug my toilet paper, pour a drink. Thank you, St. Petersburg. We love you. Don't feed the Pelicans.
Good night, Roy. Have a good man.
From stpetecatalyst.com.